This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us on our Main Street across the state this time of day. Today we're going to start our show with the author of a brand new book. William D. Green is a professor of history at Augsburg University, and the book we're going to talk about is The Children of Lincoln, White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. Bill Green joins us by phone from the Twin Cities. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
We should also note for our listeners who may recognize the name that you served as a superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, and you're a pretty well-known guy around the state of Minnesota.
Well, thank you for saying that. I hope people don't go to post offices and see my picture there instead.
Okay. You know? Hardly likely. Let's talk about this book. Why did you write this book? Because it appears to be the third in a group of books about this period of history in the state's early development.
Well, I came from New Orleans originally, and I learned at an early age, really, of the special legacy that Minnesota had with regard to civil rights leadership. Even as a kid, I was familiar with names like Hubert Humphrey and Fritz Mondale and Don Frazier and names like that. My father and my mother were active in politics in Louisiana, so I probably heard more about politics and civil rights leadership than a lot of my classmates. But I never understood what it was about Minnesota that would yield that kind of leadership when you consider the fact that there are so few black people who lived here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, all I really knew about the cultural experience in Minnesota was the Vikings. And so, you know, it was quite a question for me to try to answer. I came up here for college and stayed for grad school and for law school. And, you know, all of those experiences sort of whetted my appetite to do a formal study in that area. So I wrote a book called Degrees of Freedom, which deals with the origins of civil rights in the second half of the 19th century. And that book tended to focus on the leadership of African Americans during that period. And I was curious as to what their white patrons were like, what they did, because oftentimes that partner is neglected from the text, the history of civil rights. And so I wanted to look at them to see where they were coming from and who, the kinds of people they were.
Well, how would you characterize the place, the economy, the people of Minnesota so soon after statehood and before and during the Civil War and after?
Well, it was dynamically different from anything that I think even Minnesotans of the era expected. It was viewed to be a state that would be dependent on a farm economy, and yet by the end of the second half of the 19th century, the economy would become much more diverse and integrated with the rest of the nation. You also have a huge infusion of immigrants moving in, and with that created a different kind of flavor, both in terms of settlement on the farmland in Minnesota, but also in the city. And with that came the kinds of tensions that you would imagine, but tensions that would include labor and class, as well as ethnic tensions. And then you compound that with the fact that in the wake of the Civil War and the emancipation of freed men and women, you begin to see the presence of a growing population of African Americans coming to the city. And no one ever anticipated that Minnesota would have that kind of diversity in the population. So you have a combination of the state transitioning from an agricultural-based economy to an economy that's growing somewhat diverse with milling and things of that nature being part of commerce and transportation with the changing population. All of those things sort of created an unprecedented sort of series of challenges for the state to maneuver. And in the midst of that, you began to see the movement of African Americans, who I think were viewed to be people who would work in the countryside, come to the city and form an urban population. And all of that was unexpected as well. So Minnesota was going through incredible and unprecedented changes at the time, and no one really knew for sure how this was all going to turn out. I might also add that because Minnesota was located at the farthest corner of the United States, for all intents and purposes, much of the action was a little bit further south. Minnesota was in a unique position to avoid some of the problems that you began to see occurring in places like Illinois and Indiana. And that kind of contributed to the unique flavor of Minnesota, at least how we wanted to perceive ourselves. So,
well, when I was growing up as a school student in Minnesota, we learned about, of course, the state becoming a state in 1858, and about just a couple of years later, the first Minnesota Volunteer Infantry Regiment becomes a very important tool, if you will, in the Civil War during the Battle of Gettysburg, in particular. So there's sort of a very patriotic or Union orientation to the state. That's the impression I had growing up.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. The paradox of that is that just months before Fort Sumter was fired on in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina, that would start the Civil War. Just before that happened, the residents of St. Anthony, which was then a separate community that would now become a part of that later became a part of Minneapolis, the residents of St. Anthony and Minneapolis per se were actually walking the streets with loaded weapons. Looking at each other, waiting for the slightest provocation to open fire on their neighbors. And that was because of a slave trial that occurred in 1860. So almost overnight, even though we were on the verge of having a kind of a bleeding Minnesota, not unlike what we saw in the South in Kansas, almost overnight, once war was declared in South Carolina, Minnesotans stampeded to the registration office in order to join the army, and almost overnight they focused their sense of purpose into patriotic zeal, where they were going to confront the secessionists in the South. It's an amazing moment in history, and it's almost literally a moment in history where the enemy is viewed in different contexts.
Bill Green is the author of The Children of Lincoln, and you tell this story, which takes place between 1860 and 1876, this moment in history, from the perspective of four people. How did you pick these four people to profile in this historical moment?
Well, I thought in looking at whether the political leadership of the state followed the trends of the political leaders nationally, I wanted to look at the lives of four people in particular. I tend to think that the best way to understand history is to get granular, so to speak, is to look at the people who make history, the folks on the street, as opposed to the big names who kind of get the headlines all the time. So I wanted someone who was a politician. That's Morton Wilkinson, who would become a United States Senator, and his term ran concurrently with the Civil War. I wanted to have a businessman, D.D. Merrill, St. Paul businessman, and a church leader. He was both, and to kind of get that experience, I wanted to look at a woman who, in my view, started the suffrage movement in Minnesota, a little-known person, Sarah Berger Stearns, to kind of see how she viewed civil rights and equal treatment under the law. And finally, I selected a person who was an immigrant himself. He was an Irish Protestant immigrant who lived on a farm in Le Sueur County, Minnesota. And he had served during the Civil War as an officer in the Colored Regiment. So with these four people, I'm kind of seeing a section of Minnesota history that hadn't really been covered before. And that was one of my intents. I just wanted to get people who would tell stories that we were the least familiar with about ourselves for the most part. So.
Did Minnesota reflect an attitude towards slavery and Reconstruction and separatism that was also present in some other northern states? I mean, you mentioned Indiana and other places were not so far from the, you know, they weren't on the edge of the country at that time. Those elements were there too?
There were some similar elements in play. The by the end of the Civil War, heading into the 1870s, the population reflected the larger world. We were not isolated as we had been with a lot of westward movement. So some of the biases that you see characterized in state policy in the Midwestern states, for example, were carried out here. They didn't necessarily get the same toehold in our, you know, we didn't have black codes, for example, that you see happening in Ohio and Indiana and Illinois. But you still have this kind of prejudice that is there. In 1864, for example, when Senate was debating whether to continue allocating funds for the Freedmen's Bureau, there was a discussion as to whether northern states should encourage freedmen and women to relocate to northern states for the sake of security, because the Confederates still were in power in the South. And there was a lot of resistance in Minnesota to having blacks homestead in the state. It's one thing to free them, but it was quite another thing to encourage them to move into the state. And even though you do see blacks moving in time, that streak of resistance, of race consciousness, that it was very similar to what you see in other parts of the North. We were by that time a part of the body politic, a part of the mindset of the North. And that's one of the things that I find in this book, that indeed the four people that I focus on, for various reasons, eventually by 1870 abandoned the African American, much like the white patrons of black freedom throughout the North abandoned the African American.
Well, one of the more prominent African Americans of that time, very famous name, Frederick Douglass, came to the state, gave a speech in Winona, Minnesota, around this time we're talking about, and could not find hotel accommodation, at least in one place.
Yeah, that's a common story that he experienced traveling throughout the North, and it was certainly the case here. He spoke in St. Paul as well in 1873, and even though the person who hosted his speech was a long-term friend of his, he owned a hotel and offered Douglass a room. He made this public gesture to offer Douglass the room, but later in the evening, when Douglass went to the hotel to get the room, the concierge at the desk apparently hadn't received the order from his boss and rejected Douglass, told him, you know, we don't serve people like you. Wow. And so Douglass had to go to a couple other hotels before he eventually found a room to stay in. That bias is very much a part of the society that we lived in at that time.
Bill Green is the author of The Children of Lincoln, and the subtitle is White Paternalism and the Limits of Black Opportunity in Minnesota, 1860 to 1876. We'll be back with our discussion in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bremer Investment Services, with dedicated financial advisors offering financial plans for a secure future now and throughout retirement. Bremer Investment Services, for what's ahead. I could have danced
all night. Next time on Studio 360, how the lyricist for classic, joyous musicals like My Fair Lady wasn't always so chipper himself.
Alan was so distraught that he chewed his fingernails until they bled.
The highs and lows of Alan J. Lerner. Next time on Studio 360.
Tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined by phone by Bill Green. He's a professor of history at Augsburg University and the author of the new book, The Children of Lincoln. And Bill, when we left off, we were talking about Frederick Douglass having some difficulty finding a hotel room in Winona, Minnesota. Let's talk about this racial paternalism, the white paternalism that's in the subtitle of your book.
Right.
How was that manifested? And for how long? I mean, it seems to me probably about a century or so.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes quite subtly, sometimes quite blatantly. I think probably the best image to characterize that kind of paternalism is found in the statute that was dedicated to Lincoln. It's called the Emancipation Statute in Washington, D.C. in 1876. And probably many of your listeners are familiar with that image. Perhaps most are familiar with that image, where Lincoln is standing upright with his arms outstretched, while a freedman, a former slave, is huddled at his knee. Even though the freedman, the former slave, the chains on his wrist are broken, he's not really standing up. He is forever kind of hidden under the protection of Lincoln, and he never once stands up to be able to view Lincoln face to face. That statute seems to commemorate the patron's sense of paternalism, of the role of the black. You're free, but you're never really going to be equal. And indeed, that was how it was perceived by the people who actually attended that dedication. And it was at that dedication where Frederick Douglass, and we were just talking about him, gave me the title for my book. He gave this very long speech about how wonderful Lincoln was, and Lincoln was wonderful. But he says in the middle of the speech, you, referring to the white listeners of his speech, you are the children of Lincoln. But we, referring to black people, are at best his stepchildren. So I think that all sort of reflects the perception that that the patrons of black equality at the time, the children of Lincoln at the time, had of black people. We free them. You are now no longer slaves, but you will never really be equal to us.
We need to remember that political parties kind of morph over time. We're talking here about Lincoln Republicans, I guess, and ultimately maybe something that you refer to as radical Republicans, or at least the book references them. And the Democratic Party at that time would have been more pro the status quo, slavery, and all of that kind of thing. So
that's right.
Let's give us a little context, because now if the war is over, Lincoln has been assassinated, the great emancipator is gone, and Andrew Johnson is now the president.
That's right. Yeah, he was Lincoln's vice president. Lincoln, in an effort to plant the seeds of regional conciliation, he wanted to try to bring the nation back together again. He selected Andrew Johnson, who was not a Republican. He was a Democrat, but he was from a southern state that had not seceded from the Union. That's Tennessee. When Lincoln died, however, and Johnson became president, even though Johnson had supported the cause to keep the Union together, he was never in favor of equality or the emancipation of the slave. And he showed his contempt of those efforts by members of Lincoln's party, the Republicans, by constantly trying to undercut that work. And the consequence is that there was considerable friction that had formed between himself and the Republican Party, to the point where Johnson would actually be tried for impeachment. So it was sort of an unfortunate aftermath of Lincoln's assassination. His martyrdom would be lost, in effect, to the resurgence of white supremacy, and that resurgence took the form and the lead from President Johnson's attitudes to frustrate that movement forward for the black man.
Bill Green, the author of The Children of Lincoln, and we're talking about these three books now that you've written about civil rights and African-American life in the state of Minnesota when it was forming and in its earlier years. There's some irony here about another racial issue that's going on at the same time, and that has to do with Native American status in our state.
Right. The one of the things that I found kind of fascinating was even while the Children of Lincoln were stridently in favor of emancipation and of enfranchisement for African Americans, they were also quite hostile to natives, Native Americans. In the case of Morton Wilkinson, for example, he was a guy who was in favor of blacks serving in the military, of providing resources for slaves who were fighting in the war, to support for their families. I mean, he was a radical for all intents and purposes, and yet he wanted to exterminate the Dakota people during the Dakota conflict in 1862. And short of being able to do that, he authored legislation that would result in the removal of the Dakota and the Winnebago from Minnesota. So you have, and it's not just Wilkinson. Montgomery, for example, who I said was an Irish Protestant immigrant who served in the Union Army, fought in the Dakota War, and then later transferred into the colored regiments. But it was not unusual to see people who could support black freedom be also in support of the extermination of Native Americans. That kind of attitude was a conflicting attitude was not unusual. Jane Grey Swisshelm, who I don't write about in the book as much, but is at the time a noted journalist and abolitionist, was she was famous for her desires to want to see policies that would collect Indian scalps. And yet she's frustrated with Lincoln for not being active enough to prosecute the war and to free slaves. So it's an interesting sort of contrast. You know, these guys were people of two minds regarding peoples of color.
Well, at the same time, you've got women's suffrage being debated, black suffrage in the state of Minnesota. The Constitution was changed, wasn't it, to allow that?
That's right. The frustration that the women leadership, the women suffragists felt was that, you know, this is a time when we can change it all, where we can have universal suffrage. And indeed, in working with the men who would become considered the Children of Lincoln, they were abolitionists, but they were also reformers. And they had worked hand in glove with the women's suffrage, just basically, you know, saying that, look, when the time is right, we're going to go for women's suffrage at the same time. And then that time came in the second half of the 1860s. And not only did the male allies reject any efforts on the part of women suffragists to promote women's suffrage, we also see that rejection taking the form of some of the most vile rhetoric that you could imagine. That's the thing that's amazing. And so, you know, suffragists were feeling betrayed, understandably betrayed, and began to pursue their own policies. So, you know, once again, it's another example of how the Children of Lincoln sort of bifurcated the issues that they wanted to deal with. Just as they could be hostile to Indians while being positive to African Americans. They could be hostile to women's suffrage, the right of women to vote, while being supportive of the right of black men to vote.
Well, this is such an important moment in the state's history. It's a rich book with lots of detail that is important in terms of knowing where we are today, I guess. The Children of Lincoln is the book. The author is William Green. He's professor of history at Augsburg University. And The Children of Lincoln is available from the University of Minnesota Press. Thank you for being with us today.
Doug, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, the NPR Student Podcast Challenge. But first, the news with Todd.
Thank you, Doug. A bill draft to require state employees who have state health insurance family plans to pay a portion of that premium for the plan was rejected by a legislative committee. The bill would have required a state worker to pay 15% of the difference in premium between a single plan and a family plan. Fargo Democratic Senator Tim Mathern is a member of the legislature's Employee Benefits Committee.
We need that benefit in order to retain and recruit public employees.
The committee also rejected proposals to change the state retirement plan from a defined benefit to a defined contribution. Sponsors of the bill drafts can still introduce them on their own. Members of the Fargo City Commission have approved a law making public drinking at specific downtown events permanent. In June, commissioners approved a temporary law lifting the ban on liquor consumption at the request of the Downtown Community Partnership. It was for vendors involved in the street fair and several other downtown events on specified streets and sidewalks. It was a test to determine how the so-called open carry law would work and whether it should be continued. Well, the ordinance was allowed during four events, the downtown street fair, two Cork and Canvas events, and most recently at Winterfest during the Holiday Lights Parade. Partnership CEO Melissa Rademacher says careful planning by the police, the Downtown Community Partnership, and vendors themselves controlled the events with no problems.
It's all about the details. It's amazing that the liquor vendors that we partnered with held each other accountable, because if one didn't follow the rules, they knew that we were all going to get in trouble, which was amazing. It helped all of our jobs. We also worked with the Fargo Police in terms of the routes, all four events. They were very, very much involved, talking through all of the different scenarios and making sure the public knew as well as we were covered with signs.
The vote was 4-1. Commissioner Tony Gehrig said he supported the concept, but said it should not be limited to just downtown. He was the one to cast the only no vote. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined in studio by Tim Wollenzien. He is the Prairie Public Education Services Manager. Thanks for being with us, Tim.
Happy to be here.
And we're here to talk about the Student Podcast Challenge. This challenge is produced by NPR, National Public Radio, and joining us from Washington, D.C. is the person who's a spokesperson for the Student Podcast Challenge and is helping manage this, Claire Lombardo. Thanks for being with us, Claire.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Why did NPR decide to create this competition?
Well, we're really trying to add youth voices into the national conversation here, and we know that students across the country have a lot to say. It's also because here at NPR, we write a lot about kids in the classroom and the trends in classrooms. And we know there's a big push to rethink how schools teach and how students learn. And a lot of that is teachers are using more projects, more student-centered lessons, and they're getting students together to work in groups and teams to work collaboratively. And we figured, why not have students work to make a podcast in the classroom? It's a great project-based effort for teachers to take on and with their students.
Well, the contest is open to students between 5th and 12th grades, and we'll get into some of the nitty-gritty about how it will work. But first, I want to talk to Tim about the value of project-based learning. When I was a kid, the teacher stood in the front of the class, and that was that. You listened or you didn't. But project-based learning is this collaborative approach.
It is, and it gives kids ownership in their own learning and gives teachers accountability for the things that they bring into the classroom and projects that are designed and the way they're executed and presented and evaluated. And it's a real team approach that is slightly different than the traditional methods of teaching and learning.
Well, we do a radio show, which is highly collaborative. Broadcasting requires lots of people working in sync. So this is project-based learning that we're doing every day and a good example of what we're talking about, I guess.
Indeed.
Claire, what kind of help does NPR provide for students who are interested?
So we've put together a lot of resources for students and their teachers to use along the way. If they go to our homepage, that's npr.org/student-podcast-challenge, they'll find a series of how-to guides for getting started on a podcast, and teachers can download lesson plans that they can use, which will be especially helpful for teachers, say a history teacher who hasn't made a podcast before, to implement in the classroom.
Tim, how will Prairie Public be involved in this process?
Well, already we've started to put the word out. We have a network of teachers that we connect with through an e-newsletter and by tweeting and by retweeting and posting things. We want to get teachers thinking about this. And so at this point, just making people aware of it is our plan.
And the role of the teacher, Claire, is very important here, right?
Sure, yeah. A teacher can really actually play different roles in this in the podcast challenge. We're hoping that teachers can get their students motivated in the classroom to take this on. But this can be something that, say, an English teacher encourages her students to do as an assignment. So maybe a class would take on a podcast together and work together to put something together. But there's also an option for, say, student groups that get together after school. If those students want to make a podcast and, say, ask their teacher sponsor to help them submit it, that's also totally fine.
So what's the limit to the kind of help a teacher can provide?
Well, we're hoping that teachers obviously won't make the podcast for their students. Obviously, we want students to really take the lead in coming up with the ideas, writing the script, and also going out into the world and recording the sound that they need for their podcast. We want these ideas to come from students, but obviously we know these are probably things that are going to come from schools, and we know teachers are going to have a big part in making them happen.
What's the prize for winning?
So our winners, we're going to have one winner from our middle school category, that's 5th grade through 8th grade, and one winner from high school, that's 9th through 12th. And in the springtime, when we pick our winners, journalists from NPR will visit those podcasters at school.
Wow.
And then the winning podcasts are going to air in segments on NPR on our shows All Things Considered and Morning Edition.
Well, we would have been talking about this amongst ourselves. We know that NPR is picking these two, one middle school, one high school. And Prairie Public is considering selecting those podcasts that we think are worthy for our platform, Tim.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what better motivation for a podcast contest than to have your podcast, distributed and have people listen to it. So, any way that we can piggyback on that here would be great.
And of course, in reality, once you've created a podcast, you can distribute it. There are all kinds of social media platforms that you can put a podcast on. Claire, let's get some specifics here about what kind of length you're looking for, what kind of limitations in the production of these podcasts. You say, for example, you can't include music. So let's get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah. So we've asked that students and their teachers not include music in the podcasts, and that's really just for legal reasons. We don't want any students to get in trouble because they've accidentally used music that they don't have the permissions to.
Yes, in broadcasting, we have ASCAP BMI licensing, which means we can broadly use regular, published music that's out there, but podcasters wouldn't have that. So
yeah, exactly. We're also asking that students keep their submissions between 3 minutes and 12 minutes. So we're not expecting long, like 45-minute podcasts like sometimes you hear. 3 minutes and 12 minutes is our limit.
Tim, what do you think the potential of this is for, lots of submissions from the people who are in the Prairie Public audience?
Well, I think there's great potential. It's a project that you can really include in any kind of a class. It doesn't have to be just in your radio production class or your broadcast journalism class or your writing class. I mean, you could use this in any kind of subject area or discipline. And I think it's something that's accessible to kids of all ages. There's certainly a familiarity with the technology amongst kids from third grade and on, or really actually younger. And I think an interest in, you know, how do we communicate more broadly? And I think, you know, teachers can use this as a, again, a project-based approach to creating something like a podcast or even a larger production if kids are interested in that.
Claire, how is this going to be judged?
So we've got judges from across public radio. We've got 10 judges, like our very own Sam Sanders, who hosts the NPR podcast It's Been a Minute, and then education reporters from across the country who are going to bring their expertise in education to help us review these podcasts and pick the standout ones.
Well, we've been talking about these traditional school-based classes and projects, I guess, here, but how about homeschooled people or people who are learning online?
Yeah, homeschoolers, anyone learning online. The contest is also open to them. We've actually got an FAQ listed on our website. If you go to npr.org/student-podcast-challenge, you can read through and make sure that you are eligible for the contest. But one thing to remember is that students need the help from a teacher to submit. So, for example, if you're a parent who homeschools your student, you can submit as long as you're their teacher. But that's one necessary thing to remember.
So submissions open to teachers on the 1st of January. Give us the other dates that are critical here.
So submissions open on the 1st of January, and they'll close on March 31st. So there's that window for people to submit their entries, and then we'll be off to the races, and we'll be judging them. And later in the springtime, we'll announce our winners, and they'll start going on the radio.
Can people submit more than one podcast? I mean, I did this the first time, and then a week later, wow, now I know how to do it better.
There is not a limit to the number that people can submit, so they can go ahead and submit multiples, although we do expect that it might be a little bit more time-intensive than people know. So I would say for students who are taking on a podcast for the first time, give yourself some time to try it out and figure out your equipment before you decide you're going to make a bunch of different podcasts.
And what kind of audio quality are you listening for? Because obviously that's important.
Yeah, so we're not expecting for students to be experts on audio production, but we're just hoping that they try things out. You know, we know that students are not going to have expensive recorders and expensive software to edit these podcasts, but we're hoping that they try to, you know, interview people and include that sound, include sounds from the world around them. It's really about judging for their creativity. We've also listed out the criteria that we'll be judging on our website, and students can read through that to make sure they're really going for the right thing.
Yeah, that criteria is information and structure is 40%, personality and creativity is 40%, and production is 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so, Tim, as project-based learning, this strikes me as just an ideal kind of exercise because you've got the people you'll hear, you know, the hosts or whatever, but that's the tip of an iceberg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we want to be here as part of the process so that, you know, if students, if teachers have questions, we're here as a resource. And so we want to be part of the process and to be able to celebrate you know, the successes that kids have with this.
Claire, it strikes me that you might open some floodgates here. You might get lots of submissions, but also just spark a lot of activity, podcast activity that might blossom all across the country.
Yeah, we're really excited to see what we get, and we're anticipating a lot.
All right. Well, Claire Lombardo is a spokesperson for NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Tim Wollenzien is Prairie Public's Education Services Manager. Always a pleasure to see you, Tim.
Thank you.
And again, more information at np.org/student-podcast-challenge. More Main Street in a moment.
Hey, teachers. No need to brave the cold for great professional development. Join Prairie Public's weekly web chats from the cozy, convenient comfort of your home or classroom. This free series features area educators sharing resources, ideas, tips, and tricks to help other teachers maximize their teaching power. Chats are every Tuesday and Thursday, and continuing education credit is available. Go to prairiepublic.org to learn more.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Your childhood shapes you for better or worse. For Tina Dietz, a childhood with a beloved relative and several horses set the stage. Dietz visited the StoryCorps mobile recording booth with her significant other, Patrick Conte. In this excerpt, we learn about the lives that shaped Tina's life.
I had the honor of experiencing old school country living. My great Aunt Shirley, she lived on a farm in Salford, two-room house. We didn't have indoor plumbing. We pumped from the well. If we bathed, it was out in a wash tub. We used an outhouse. It was just really old world, and I loved it.
You love horses.
A lot of that was from Aunt Shirley. Well, when I was two, I have a picture of me sitting. It was her horse. She was a paint. Her name was Flicka. Flicka had the worst haircut ever. Like, it's so horrible. Her mane was so chopped up. There I am sitting in my pink outfit. I was just happy. She specifically had a Shetland pony for the younger kids to ride. His name was Dusty. I would jump down in some of the ravines and eat wild strawberries and ruin my supper and get scolded.
Tell me more about Aunt Shirley and just her impact.
She was a whole, like, probably 4'10" on a really tall day in really big shoes. She was just so feisty and so independent and just her zest for life.
That's how I would describe you.
Everybody always said I was a lot like her. I talk too much. I run my mouth. But for me, that's probably the greatest compliment.
Yeah.
Because she meant so much to me.
Yeah.
She never married. She told me about her boyfriend one time, the one and only boyfriend she had, and then said that we were never to speak of him again. She ran a farm. She ran cattle. She had horses, pigs. She did it.
What do you think would be your fondest memory of the farm or Shirley?
Gosh, my fondest. I really wish I would have kept the letters she wrote. I had a lot of childhood trauma.
Yeah.
I wrote to my Aunt Shirley.
Yeah.
I asked her to try to take me away from my parents.
Yeah.
Because I was happy. With her, I was protected. I was safe. She loved me no matter what I did.
Yeah.
She wrote me back, and she reassured me I always had someplace safe to land, someone to love me.
Yeah.
The absolute best memory with her. She had had a stroke. I went over to the emergency room as soon as I knew she was there. And she continued to have strokes, and eventually she wasn't able to talk. My youngest son was maybe 2 months old. I sat on the floor next to her, and I showed her pictures of him, and I talked to her about my life. And I kissed her on the forehead before I left.
Yeah.
I told her I loved her. And I went to walk out the door. And clear as day, the first time she had been able to talk in years, she said, "I love you too."
Wow.
She went home to Jesus the next day.
Whenever you tell me about her, it's... I'm like, that's you. That's exactly how you are.
It is.
Strong, independent, sassy, stubborn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She really showed me what unconditional love was.
Right. That's the type of mom that you are.
I try to be.
Yeah.
My kids got to meet her, and that means the world to me.
Right. Tell me about Lady.
She was absolutely amazing. She would hug me. It was the craziest thing to have a horse just lower her head on your shoulder and just relax. She came to me.
Yeah.
She would listen to me. She was so good with my kids. It was phenomenal. And then on June 25th of 2017, I had a ride that changed everything. I got up on her like I had countless other times when we rode down the road. She spooked on me, and she reared. My head hit the ground, and then it hit again. From the impact of her hitting my leg, I laid there. Lady went back to the farm without a rider.
What made you get up?
My kids needed me. I really just wanted to lay on the road and close my eyes. 2 weeks later, I got back up on her bareback. For the first time, a horse scared me. I sold her. I gave up my dream. And then I got to pass my dream on to another little girl. She was 9 years old, and Grandma bought her a horse. And I got to see a picture of her up on Lady smiling. I know that smile. I got to help foster the love of horses for another little girl, just like Aunt Shirley had fostered my love of horses. I want to turn on the road to go see her, but maybe someday.
Someday, yeah.
Day.
Dietz and Conte visited the StoryCorps mobile recording booth during its month-long visit to North Dakota this past summer. This excerpt was edited by Prairie Public. Our thanks to Basin Electric for sponsoring the StoryCorps visit. Dakota Date Book is next.
Thanks to the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting our arts programming. They are now offering their special edition ornaments. This year, spearfishing decoys, small, hand-carved, individually painted fish made by North Dakota master craftsman Rick Whittier. See them at nd.gov/arts or the North Dakota Heritage Center gift shop.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 4th. On this date in 1908, Mary Wright was a topic of conversation throughout North Dakota. In August of that year, she was arrested and held in jail at Devil's Lake. She was accused of killing her 16-year-old stepdaughter, Beulah Cox. Authorities originally theorized that Wright was jealous of the girl and put poison in her food. Wright and her stepdaughter boarded on the farm where they worked. Many witnesses testified to the many arguments between the two. A preliminary hearing had been held in September. The courtroom was crowded with spectators eager to get a glimpse of the accused. The Evening Times of Grand Forks described the case as the most interesting that has been brought before the courts in this state in some time. Wright sat like a statue, showing no emotion as the hearing began. Two friends of Beulah occupied front row seats. They, too, were a center of attention. The first witness was a friend of Beulah's who had been with her the night before she died. Annie Wunderlich testified that Beulah had told her of being beaten and threatened by Wright. Beulah had even said she was afraid that Wright was going to poison her. The next witness was Henry Miller, who was courting Annie Wunderlich. He spent the evening with Annie and Beulah at Annie's house, then walked Beulah home at 1:30 in the morning. He testified that Beulah told him of the harsh treatment she had received from Wright. He said he heard Wright threaten to kill Beulah. Another boarder in the house confirmed Miller's statement that Wright and Beulah had a contentious relationship. He testified that he frequently heard Wright and Beulah arguing. He was eating a meal when Wright came to him and told him that Beulah was dead in her bed. Other witnesses reinforced the testimony about the stormy relationship. The theory of Beulah's death changed during the trial. The prosecution put forth the theory that Mrs. Wright was furious that the girl had gone out at night and stayed out late. Wright was accused of losing her temper and choking the girl to death, then putting carbolic acid on her lips to make it look like the girl had committed suicide. In February of 1909, a jury found Mary Wright guilty of manslaughter. She was sentenced to 5 years in the penitentiary. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
It's 2018. You knew that, but also this year is the 100th anniversary of the end of the Great War, the war to end them all, World War I. One of our Dakota Datebook writers, Jim Davis, had the idea of doing a series that chronicled North Dakota's experience for the 19 months of America's participation in the Great War. And not just the trench and poison gas stuff, a lot of these pieces are about what was going on at home. A lot of you told us they were really interesting. So we took all the scripts and put them together into a file you can download and read, a sort of an ebook, 83 pages of North Dakota and the Great War. Go to prairiepublic.org/radio and get a copy. prairiepublic.org/radio, North Dakota and the Great War.
A diplomat who served under President George H.W. Bush recalls a president who believed in assembling global coalitions.
He thought that we should look at a world order in which there would be equality and fairness.
And who privately argued for human rights.
That people would be treated justly.
But the legacy of the president who presided over the end of the Cold War is complex. Remembering George H.W. Bush on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, a new report by the Williams Institute at the UCLA School of Law estimates almost 700,000 LGBT U.S. adults have received conversion therapy. The therapy is the subject of the new film Boy Erased. It's a practice the American Psychiatric Association strongly opposes. We'll discuss the issue with NDSU professor Christy McGeorge. And News Director Dave Thompson will discuss Governor Burgum's budget address. And we'll talk about a new documentary film, North Dakota Goes to War, 1898-1899. It's the story of the first North Dakota infantry volunteers, men who fought in the Philippines during the Spanish-American War. It's scheduled to premiere Monday at the Fargo Theater. We'll visit with Angela Smith, an associate professor of history at NDSU, and doctoral candidate Carol Butcher, who writes for Dakota Datebook and whose dissertation is about the soldiers and their role in the war. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.